Hi, my name is David Wayne, and this is For the Record program number 1326. Interviews with Matt Clumpton, Jim DeGenio, and Paul Boyle about the Oswald impersonators and chokeholds. Once again, gentlemen, it is my pleasure and privilege to bring you back to our airwaves, and we will be talking about one of the really amazing aspects of the Oswald impersonators. But Paul, you had something you wanted to mention about some of the reviews that we have gotten, the book has gotten on Amazon.
Well, yeah, I think the reviews overall have been great, but you can tell just recently by the pattern and the intensity. I mean, I'm not talking about a huge intensity, but three of the last four are kind of weird reviews. I'd let your listeners to go and see him. I mean, one person claims that the book is almost disintegrating into his hands, like the sheets are flying all over the place. And I know for a fact that unless it's one lemon that he got his hands on, but they're a good quality. They're well printed and they're well produced. And I know many people who've had it, but it's things of that nature and there's nothing substantive. So it smells and it rings of fake, what they call review bombs. The point is that people who've read it and who liked it, if you can take the few minutes to go and write it, because if the most recent review pops up first, that's what people will read. You can go to most recent, for instance. And they're swamped by positive reviews. And if you can do that, we certainly, as the authors, appreciate it. Thank you.
And I want to stress that neither myself nor any of the stations that air this program get any money whatsoever from this. It's simply for purposes. We have been talking about Oswald impersonators, and I don't think there is anything that impacts more negatively upon the official version, the Warren Commission's fiction, frankly, than the, quote, Oswalds, unquote, who were doing all kinds of interesting things with regard to trucks, munitions, the Free Cuba Committee. This, well, the real Lee Harvey Oswald was in the former Soviet Union. But based on my old quiz show, What's My Line? And one of the panelists was Dorothy Kilgallen, whose demise, when she had interviewed Jack Ruby, is something that the audience is familiar with. Matt, while Oswald, the real Lee Harvey Oswald, was in the former Soviet Union, were people calling themselves Lee Harvey Oswald doing some very interesting and from the standpoint of deep politics, very revealing things here in the U.S.?
Yeah. So the first thing, probably the most, well, maybe not the most notable, but the first thing definitely was Oswald. And this is during the time when we know that Lee Harvey Oswald is in the Soviet Union, you know, October 1959 through June of 62, he's over in the Soviet Union. And on January 20th, right in that window, January 20th, 1961, two men visit the Bolton Ford dealership in New Orleans. And they ask about buying 10 Ford Econoline trucks, and both the assistant manager, Oscar DeSlatt, and his boss, Fred Sewell, interacted with these guys. And they said they represented the Friends of Democratic Cuba. And the people that were there, the two guys, their names were Joseph Moore and Lee Oswald. Hey, look at that. The bid form only says Oswald. It doesn't have a first name, but Fred Sewell, the manager, said that in the Clay Shaw trial that, you know, it was Lee Oswald, and that's what he remembered. So what's crazy is, you know, the Friends of Democratic Cuba, that organization, you know, it's incorporated by Guy Bannister, and you know, who people familiar with the case know very well. Incidentally, on my podcast, Solving JFK, I'm deep, deep in Guy Bannister land right now. Lots of destiny betrayed in my life, Jim. Thank you very much. So you got Guy Bannister, and then another incorporator is Gerard Tujak or Tuhaig, not certain about the pronunciation, but bottom line, it's a guy who Oswald had worked for. So what are the chances of that? The guy who is associated with Oswald in New Orleans, and that's a separate conversation, but there's, I think, overwhelming evidence for that. And then who was Oswald's boss. And then they have formed an organization, Friends of Democratic Cuba, where they use Oswald's name to buy these trucks. It's really wild stuff. So that then triggers FBI head J. Edgar Hoover to write a memo to the Office of Security at the State Department on June 3rd, 1960, acknowledging the possibility that someone was impersonating Oswald. He said, quote, "Since there's a possibility that an imposter is using Oswald's birth certificate, any current information the Department of State may have concerning Oswald will be appreciated." So we got that from Hoover. Hoover's always in the loop on like the granular details. So, you know, you can accuse Hoover of being maniacal, but at least it's kind of refreshing. All of the CEOs today are just not involved in the details. Hoover was in the details. Anyway, I'm kind of joking, but seriously. Anyway, then there are other sightings. So it's not just Bolton Ford. There's another car dealership. They love going to car dealerships. Says that, this guy James Spencer worked at a car dealership in New Orleans. He says sometime between February and August of 1961, he met with Lee Oswald about purchasing a 1958 Chevy, and he met with him twice. And during the second meeting, he had coffee with him and talked a lot about Cuba and how great Fidel Castro was. And, what's interesting is, He found a business card that said Lee Oswald Magazine Street. So that's actually really crazy, because Oswald doesn't move to New Orleans until the summer of 63. So the fact that you're going to put him on Magazine Street in 1961 is a little spooky. But anyway, then we have Ray Carney. This is a different type of story. But he's a news correspondent in Dallas, and he's contacted by an anti-Castro Cuban who attempts to recruit him as a pilot and wants his assistance in getting publicity. And then supposedly Carney he obtained the names of pilots who wanted to volunteer for the anti-Castro force, and provided them to the Cuban general and to the FBI. And he says he was also contacted by Lee Harvey Oswald in the late part of 1960 or the early part of 1961. And he said the person that he thought was Oswald asked for the names of the volunteers and expressed pro-Castro sympathies to Carney in an effort to convince him that, you know, Castro was right, but Carney refused to give Oswald the names. So there's another person impersonating him, and this is in a pro-Castro, context, which, many of them were, but Friends of Democratic Cuba, that's in an anti-Castro context. Let's see other, that's, you know, there are others, probably little ones here and there, but those are the main ones in Russia.
And of course, Guy Bannister, he was the central, resident at the dual 531 Camp Street, 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place address, and he was running Lee Harvey Oswald after Oswald got back from the former Soviet Union. We've spoken about that before. But again, this is the sightings of Oswald working for the Friends of a Democratic Cuba. Excuse me, I was remembering that as the Free Cuba Committee, wrong group. But this is while Oswald is in the Soviet Union. And so obviously he could not have been doing these things in the U.S. because he was in the Soviet Union. And then the things that this quote Oswald unquote was doing were altogether relevant. By the way, the gentleman Jerome, and I'm not going to try the last name. I'll let you gentlemen do it. Capital P-U-J-A-G-U-E. He was another incorporator of the Friends of Democratic Cuba, and he also employed Oswald in the mid-50s.
Right.
Oh, who's this? Sorry, Dave, who employed him?
Pugh, Pugue, however that's pronounced, reading directly from Chokol's here. Another incorporated was Gerard Pugue, who briefly employed Oswald in 1955 and 1956 at the Sandler Building in New Orleans.
Two Jags are better than one, baby.
Yeah. That's crazy.
It is, and you know, if one again is looking at the official version, well, Oswald was a lone nut, and then Ruby was the second lone nut, and as the popular long-standing expression has it, that dog won't hunt. And it is more than a little revealing that there are, quote, Lee Harvey Oswalds, unquote, in the U.S., while the real Oswald was in the Soviet Union, laying down evidentiary tributaries which overlap in various ways the aspects of the JFK assassination that we have spoken about.
But you know, Dave, if I can chime in, something that I find absolutely, you know, when you think about this, right? All the excuses, you know, to negate troubling witnesses is that, well, they had to be wrong, right? Oswald, they say Oswald was here, but he was known to be there and this and that and so on. And that's coming from the FBI. Yet Hoover himself says, we have to consider the possibility that Oswald is being impersonated while he's in Russia. So that possibility, you know, doesn't bother him when, you know, I mean, in the 1959 or 1960, yet it doesn't even make it on the radar when it has to deal with the period preceding the assassination. So it seems to be like, you know, a double standard right there.
I'll also just add that I don't think that, I think the fact that this Bolton Ford incident happens, what is it, 1961. And what's he doing? He's being portrayed as an anti-Castro, person hanging out with anti-Castro people, right? So, you know, that conflicts with the legend that he creates in the summer of 1963, the pro-Castro. So, that kind of makes me think that, they didn't know how they were going to use him. They just knew he was going to be involved with Cuba somehow and there were going to be two of them. You know what I mean? Like, it's a little weird.
Paul, you want to comment on what Matt just added?
Well, sorry. If I get the exact year, right? 1961. Because there's a period up to 59, 58 where, you know, being on Castro's side just before he took over wasn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, you know, Sturgis and others were helping Castro at the time. And the United States didn't make up their mind that he was a bad guy until pretty close to after he got in. So yeah, it must have been a little bit bewildering how people had to change camps back and forth around the 59 to 61 period. And then, you know, when he became persona non grata, well, then, you know, all sorts of strategies and impersonations and who was helping who had to change. One guy who came to mind, and I think we talk about it, is a guy called McKeon, who shows up in another chapter. And this involves a possible quote unquote impersonation of Oswald, is McKeon is the guy that Ruby approach to try and get into Cuba so that he could spring Trafficante. And McKeon was known to be a very good friend of Castro's and had supplied arms to the point that at one point he did jail time. So he was one of the guys who was caught, you know, in this time warp type of thing. But what does McKeon report? Shortly before the assassination, he says that Oswald showed up at his door with a Latino trying to buy four Savage rifles. Here, what was the idea here? It was that, oh boy, you know, Castro's friend, Castro, you know, imagine if it had been Castro's supplier of guns, would have been the person who would have supplied somehow Oswald with the kill rifle. So that, you know, it didn't really make it into the impersonations aspect of what we're doing, but you can add that to being really weird. Yeah, we'd be up to 21, right?
Well, one of the things that strikes me too about the entire issue of the Oswald impersonators, aside from the chokehold, I mean, if Oswald was a blown nut, how can they got these people impersonating a blown nut? That doesn't compute. How so many of these sightings of Oswald impersonators begin to gravitate, I would say almost inevitably, to what, for lack of a better term, might be called some of the deep political aspects of the JFK assassination landscape. And in that regard, I would like to ask Matt to develop for us the Oswald who was seen in the parking lot of the El Chico restaurant. Tell us about the Texas license plate PP4537. Who was Carl Mather? What were his links to Air Force One and to Officer J.B. Pippin? Again, a very interesting concatenation.
Yeah, that this is another one. This is kind of like the Ralph Yates one where you're just, it's kind of hard to believe. So, basically after, and I think you kind of have to mention the prequel to this is, Oswald exiting the rear of the Texas theater. So we'll throw that in there too. So, you know, when Oswald's arrested, of course he comes out the front, but there are two people who say that they saw him go out the back: Butch Burroughs, the concessions guy, and Bernard Hare, who owned Bernie's hobby house next door. And Bernard Hare, actually, his whole life, he was sure that, you know, he saw Oswald go out the back and that was how he did it. He didn't know that Oswald actually came out the front, until much later. But at any rate, they both said that the guy that went out the back in cuffs, by the way, looked just, if it wasn't Oswald, it must have been his brother, is what Butch Burroughs said. So a guy who looks like Oswald is at the Texas Theater. Near the Texas Theater, just several blocks away from the Texas Theater. Well, El Chico, I don't want to state where it's in Oak Cliff. Okay. So it can't be that far away from the Texas Theater. We have the El Chico restaurant, and there's a guy named T.F. White. He's an employee of Mac Pate's garage that is pretty close to the Texas Theater. 2 o'clock on the day of the assassination, so right after Oswald's arrested is when this would be. This would be right after they take him out the front. He's in the police car with his 35 wallets or however many wallets he has. And then, you know, according to Bernie Hare and Butch Burroughs, there's another guy who comes out the back. Okay. So at the El Chico restaurant, Mac Pate sees this guy in a 1961 Red Falcon pull into the parking lot across the street of the restaurant. Then he knows that the assassination had happened and the guy was acting suspicious. So he just walked over. He ends up making eye contact with the guy. And he says he's wearing a white t-shirt, and he writes down the guy takes off. And, he writes down the license plate. It's Texas PP4537. And then when he's watching TV that night, he sees Lee Harvey Oswald on TV, and he says, the guy I saw at the El Chico parking lot that was in that car was identical to the guy on TV. So he says he saw Oswald. And, of course, he didn't know that Oswald was already in police custody at that time. So what's crazy is this guy, Wes Wise, who goes on to become mayor of Dallas, but he was a newscaster. He's giving a talk at the El Chico restaurant, and, Mac Pate, T.F. White's boss, goes over and, you know, tells Wise the story of what his employee had seen, gives him the license plate and says, "Hey, can you run this and figure out, you know, what it is, and you know, who this person is?" And it goes back to a 1957 Plymouth owned by Carl Mather. So, different car, because the car was a 1961 Falcon. So, but the license plate goes back to Carl Mather. All right. So who's Carl Mather? According to the FBI, he did high security communications work for Collins Radio, which is a CIA contractor. For example, Mather personally installed the special electronics equipment that was on Vice President Johnson's Air Force Two plane. He refused to speak to the FBI when they wanted to talk to him. And, finally, his wife spoke to the FBI and she relayed to them the information that Mather was very close friends with Officer Tippit. Now here's where it's crazy. So close that the way they found out Tippit was killed is Tippit's wife called them to tell them. So that's very, you know, the recent widow is not going to be the one to call you unless you're in a very, very close circle. So, anyway, Mather, eventually the HSCA wants him to testify. He agrees to interview conditioned upon being granted immunity. And he says he couldn't explain how it's his license plate or how it came up with that. He didn't have any answers. And he kind of, and I believe, it's been a minute since I looked at this, but I believe he pled the fifth to, or no, that's not, he didn't plead the fifth because he had immunity. But why would he need immunity is the question. And why did it go back to him? I mean, it's, you have to speculate about what that means, but it seems like it's not nothing, you know?
Oh, no, it's not nothing at all. I like the double negative under the circumstances.
There's a couple of things that Matt left out about this that makes it even weirder. Mather and his wife were at Tippett's house that afternoon, later in the afternoon. Okay. Secondly, the very first person that George de Morenschild introduced the Oswalds to was Admiral Bruton, who ran Collins Radio. All right. Okay. So if you want to get any more coincidental, okay, I don't think you get more wilder coincidences than Collins Radio, which was a big CIA, a big CIA contract employer. Okay. With this whole milieu that Oswald and Tippit and Marina are a part of. I mean, it's really kind of amazing, you know, when you think about it.
Something that I want to interject very quickly. J.D. Tippit himself is a very interesting person. James McBride wrote a book called Into the Nightmare that goes into Tippit at
Joe late. McBride.
Phil McBride, excuse me, Joseph McBride, wrote a book called Into the Nightmare, in which he goes into J.D. Tippit's background and foreground and a lot of things. And Tippit himself figures very interestingly in the entire assassination landscape. Some researchers, Tippit was an excellent shot, and some researchers have maintained that Tippit might actually have been, quote, badge man, unquote, an apparent rifleman wearing a Dallas PD uniform firing from behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll. So J.D. Tippit himself is a very interesting character, and it is more interesting still to see him hooked up with Carl Mather from Collins Radio and this entire imbroglio that we're looking at.
Yes. I mean, well, that almost goes without saying, you know, but, you know, the idea that George de Morenschild would introduce the Oswalds to the guy who was running Collins Radio right off the bat, because, you know, most people believe, well, most people who study this case believe that George de Morenschild was on assignment. Okay. When he befriended the Oswalds and started showing him around the Dallas. In fact, he admitted this later, before he passed away, that he told Edward Epstein, you know, I would have never met Oswald in 100 years unless J. Walton Moore, the CIA station chief in Dallas, told me to do it. Okay? So this is very, very, very interesting, this whole Carl Mather. And, you know, the idea which Matt kind of underplayed, is that Oswald or an Oswald lookalike was in a car registered to Carl Mather in the moments after the JFK assassination, all right? and he seems to be escaping from the, I mean, that's just wild, you know? I mean, how the heck could something like that happen? You know, really, really bizarre. You know, and if T.F. White had not gone over there and written down that license plate, we likely would have never known about it.
Right.
You know, Mats, you were right to present this in a two part, right? Because what you're doing is you're finding a link between a lookalike that gets out of the theater from the back handcuffed, right? Then he's seen at El Chico's, right? But there's a third part. The third part, right, is that the, he's seen on a plane with a Latino, you know, boarding a plane and heading to New Mexico, you know, so there's sort of a continuity in timeline, right?
Yeah.
The same sort of continuity you had, you pointed out, I think, you know, with him being seen in the pancake house and then picked up by the person. So you're almost following him.
Well, you know, there's something we should add about the Dobbs house, you know, and I'm not sure if Matt mentioned it, but Tippett used to frequent that place. Okay. The Dobbs house, you know, for breakfast. And I think in Sylvia Marr's book, she quotes a waitress as saying that Oswald and Tippett were there once that she recalled at the same time, you know. So, you know, you just start putting all these, you know, these occurrences that the Warren Commission tried to dismiss, you know, as being something like happenstance. I don't even think the Warren Commission never interviewed Mather. I'm pretty positive about that. They never even interviewed Mather. And correct. Mather would not consent to an interview with the House Select Committee. He got a lawyer and they had to negotiate the terms and conditions. And his interview was classified for a long, long, long time. Okay. That's how hot, you know, that whole Collins radio connection was. I mean, come on. Here you have this alleged communist. The first guy he meets via George Morenchild is an admiral, okay? And the admiral is running this CIA contract place, you know? I mean, Jesus, criminy, you know? How far out can you get?
Well, you know, you're talking about far out, and one of the most far out things that has impact of our culture is the whole UFO phenomenon and the Roswell base. Roswell Air Force Base fits directly into the scenario you just touched on, Jim. Matt, if you would develop the situation of Air Force Sergeant Robert G. Vinson, what he experienced on that day, where he wound up, and with whom he wound up.
Yeah, this is a wild one. I mean, this is really a crazy story. And it comes from Air Force Sergeant Robert Vinson's book, which was written by an attorney out of Kansas, I believe. But he you know, had a guy help him write the book. But it's mostly told firsthand, so... In terms of, you know, the credibility of this, it is, I'll say that it is, does, you know, weigh heavily on this one person, but I'll also say there's no reasons to believe that person's not credible, and they present all their evidence in his book. Anyway, so there's this guy named Robert, and I'm going to paraphrase here because, you know, I don't want to, I'm going to leave out some details. I'll just hit you with the overview. There's a guy named Robert Vinson. And he's stationed out of Colorado, but he's got business in Washington. He was overdue for a promotion and he wanted to go in person to see, you know, what was going on with his promotion. So, and he's in the Air Force. All right. So he goes to DC. He finishes his business there and he wants to come back to Colorado. So he's in Colorado Springs, I believe. So he gets a flight. He's trying to get a flight on a military plane and it's on November 22nd, 1963. He's basically just trying to, you know, bum a ride back west. And, he's told at the last minute that, there is a flight that's going west and that he can get on. It's a C-54 cargo plane, that's going to Lowry Air Force Base in Denver. He said that when he went out there, when he got on the plane, it was unmarked, but it had a logo of an egg-shaped earth crossed by white grid marks, which Vinson later learned was a logo for the CIA. Vinson, he gets on the plane. He doesn't sign any sort of flight log. And he says it's just two men with coveralls that go past him and basically the pilot and another guy. And so he's the only one, the only other person on the plane. And at 12:29, the pilot announces, that the president had been shot. And then he says immediately after the announcement, the plane banked to the left and they changed course to go to Dallas, and they landed in Dallas in a rough sandy area alongside the Trinity River that wasn't a runway, but it was an area that was under construction. And, the cargo door opened and these two guys come running on. One guy is a Latin looking guy who's 6 foot, 6'1", 190 pounds. And the other guy, the other guy, when Vincent would get home and see on TV, he would later identify, of course, as Lee Harvey Oswald that gets on this plane. So, those two guys get on the plane, they go past Vincent, and, they end up landing in Roswell, the Roswell Air Force Base. So everyone else gets off the plane, but when Vincent tries to leave, he finds that the entire base is shut down and had been cleared out because everyone was on alert. The base had been shut down and cleared out, and he couldn't leave because everyone was on alert. So he was finally, the next day or hours, half a day later, he was finally allowed to go back to Colorado. And he, soon after that, the FBI starts talking to Vincent's neighbors, he and his wife were both forced to sign a secrecy agreement, according to Vincent. And then in 1964, Vincent's ordered to go to Washington for a special project. And when he gets there, he finds that it's actually to meet with the CIA, who are offering him a job, and then he turned the job down and went home. 3 months later, he's assigned to the Air Force, assigns him to a top secret CIA project at Area 51 for the Blackbird SR-71 spy plane. So Vincent ends up going to work for the CIA by assignment from the Air Force when he won't take the job. And, he had no special training or skills to qualify him for that, but they assigned him to the CIA, and he received a salary from the Air Force and monthly cash payments from the CIA during his career. And basically he ended up working at Area 51, and that's his story. And then he came forward with everything. And so, that would be the Oswald lookalike's exit out of Dallas, if that's credible. And, there's no counter out. He was in the CIA. He has military records to establish what he's saying. So,
Yeah. But I think the lawyer's name, was it not Johnson?
Matt, yes.
Or,
yes.
Okay. So I read that book, and the steps Johnson takes to corroborate, like he checked, did that flight that he describes actually take place? And he proves that it did. And then that landing strip, a weird little landing strip in Dallas, it existed. And it happened to be on a point that made sense for a getaway from the grassy knoll area, So he also checked out, communications and Vincent's relationship with the CIA, and everything, he said, made sense, and he couldn't poke holes into his story. So, and I think the other thing too is that Vincent wasn't looking for publicity at all around this. It wasn't as if he was trying to make millions on a book or anything. So I found it quite, and that's a recurring theme with chokeholds, Dave, is if you look, there's like hundreds and hundreds of footnotes, and they tend to be, I'm saying tend to be, they're either primary evidence or occasionally from authors who use primary evidence.
Once again, as well, we have stated several times, if Oswald was a lone nut, what are all of these impersonators doing? I mean, lone nuts don't get impersonated by definition. They're not lone, even if they're nuts, which Oswald was not. Some of the many, and again, Matt, you have presented many different Oswald impersonators. The Postal Forwarding Order in New Orleans. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Postal Forwarding Order. Sorry, it's been a minute since I've looked at that particular one. I have some other ones I'm excited to talk to you about, though. The Postal Forwarding Order. So, October 11th, 1963, he sends a notice to change forwarding order from New Orleans to Dallas. And the purpose was to forward mail from his New Orleans P.O. box to Ruth Payne's home address. But even as Warren Commission counsel Wesley Liebler noted, you know, we know that Oswald was in Dallas on October 11th and he wasn't in New Orleans. So somebody sending this, this change for him on his behalf. And, that's, you know, we don't have any evidence for what's actually happening, but, you know, there's nobody receiving mail for Oswald and sending it for New Orleans. So we don't know, you know what I mean? Who could that be? There's
see, Oswald was back in Dallas by about October the 4th. Okay. So, I think he stayed at a YMCA on his first night back from allegedly Mexico City. Okay. Which I don't think he went to, but that's the story. So, in other words, Oswald was in town already for about a week. So, who's sending this forwarding thing to Dallas from New Orleans then? Because Marina, we know, is staying with Ruth Payne. And she's been there for more than a week. Okay? So, who could possibly be sending this?
If you, I may make a suggestion here to give our friend Matt a little break. Because he's covering a lot of them. I find there are two here, Dave, only if you want to, but are fascinating, but deserve mention. If you want, I can mention why I find Washington, D.C. really interesting. And I think there's not much better than Jim on Mexico City, because Mexico City is, I think, a slam dunk. You have pretty well Hoover saying he was impersonated. The voice on the tapes are not Oswald's. But if he, I, you think that it might be an idea that we get into those two if we have time? I just want to make sure we don't miss them.
We can. The only consideration in that regard, Paul, is that we have, on this program in front of this audience, and probably did, we've covered Mexico City at some length, but there are things, for example, the Redbird Airport sighting. Or
that's really interesting.
Yes.
Or the Washington D.C. sighting and the whole consideration of some of the Oswald impersonators appearing unhinged or misbehaving as the person at Bob's house was apparently doing, which caused Pippet at one point to shoot him a glance. So I think we can certainly get into Mexico City if we have time, but there are so many different things in this essay or events that the audience may not be familiar with that. I would like to present those to the audience. Redbird Airport. Let's start with there.
Well, Jim. Okay, go ahead. I'll do Washington if you want to.
Yeah, Jim, you take that one.
Me?
Redbird.
Yeah, Redbird, right?
No, why don't you take Redbird? You know that very well.
All right, cool. Basically, Redbird Airport is an airport in Dallas. It's a small airport. And shortly before the assassination, this guy with an awesome name, Wayne January is the name. It's a great name. He says that these two people come in to see about chartering a plane. And it's a man and a lady. And then somebody else was sitting in the vehicle in the right front passenger seat. And so they stayed in the car. And January, they were asking questions, they wanted to go to the Yucatan Peninsula. Okay. And they had chartered the plane for, here we go, Friday, November 22nd. Okay. And this was on Wednesday, November 20th. Wow. So that's the same day of the Ralph Yates and the Dobbs house. What if it's the same guy? And he's just like, I'm going to make so many moves today. Could be. Anyway, cause we know Oswald was working that day, but, a few days later, after President Kennedy is assassinated, January recognizes the man who stayed in the passenger seat on Wednesday morning as the man accused of killing President Kennedy on TV, Lee Harvey Oswald. So the FBI report notes that January's story says that he was unsure whether the individual was Oswald, and they say that the incident happened in July of 1963, which is less exciting than just a few days before the assassination. But then there's an author named Matthew Smith who went back and asked January about that. And he said, no, it happened the Wednesday before the assassination and that he could identify Oswald 9 out of 10. So again, one more, this is another escape. It's like, man, this is elaborate. There's the actual escape and then there's the fake escape. Maybe who knows?
Paul, the unhinged, quote, Oswald, unquote, Washington, D.C.
Yeah, this is why I find this one stands out for a few reasons. First off, there's another chokehold in the book called The Prior Plots to Kill, frame Oswald, or The Prior Plots, excuse me, to assassinate JFK. And this ties around a potential plot, except that, you know, we were saying there were potential patsies that resembled Oswald left, right, and center, depending on what city he could have been assassinated in. We talked about Thomas Arthur Valley, Policarpo Lopez, who had, you know, similarities with Oswald that are, you know, you can't just explain by happenstance. Except that in Washington, we're talking about over a month, nearly a month before Dallas, JFK was supposed to have a motorcade. He did have a motorcade with the leader of Ethiopia, Selassie. And Richard Case Nagel claims to have warned the FBI about an attempt that could take place. And he was referring to the Baltimore, Washington area. It's a bit hazy, but there's that. The second thing is, you had so many traces of Oswald writing to the Fair Play for Cuba committee, writing to some of these communist publications, saying that he was planning a move to Washington, right? So these are traces. And then all of a sudden in Washington, there's an Oswald lookalike acting unhinged near the Willard Hotel. And he's acting the same sort of way his behavior is similar to what you would have seen at the Sportsdrome and many of the other cases that Matt described. So it seemed to be, hey, well, he could be our patsy also in Washington if we need to use him there. So let's try and come up with a plot around that. That's what it looked like. But here's the kicker. The key witness in this guy was a government chauffeur, for one of the, you know, I don't know if it was a director, I think it was somebody in agriculture or treasury. And it was a chauffeur, and he's the one who observed this, belligerent Oswald. What Vince Palomara found, and he got all the documentation, is that the person who took all the, in other words, took the evidence or listened to this guy called Thompson, the chauffeur, and took his testimony, was no other than secret agent Floyd Boring. Now, for anybody who follows Vince's work, Floyd Boring happens to be maybe one of the top four persons of interest in the Secret Service for the weak security in Dallas. And perhaps being, you know, in the dropping, lowering of the guard and lowering of security. So that whole instance in terms of another prior plot, an Oswald acting belligerent, an Oswald setting himself up to potentially having been there during a motorcade, and the fact that it's persons of interest like Floyd Boring or a person of interest like Floyd Boring who took the testimony just stinks. It stinks. So that's in the case of an Oswald impersonation that is not in Dallas, that is not in New Orleans, but it's elsewhere, and that it stands out you know, for its own reasons.
By the way, you made a reference to Richard Case Miguel. He is the central figure in Dick Russell's long book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, from 1992. So that is the reference there. One of the things, a quote, Oswald, unquote, was buying, drumroll feather, beer and candy in Beeley Plaza. He certainly had rarefied tastes, I think. Tell us about that, Matt, if you would.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, this is, let's see, Fred Moore, who worked at the Jiffy store at 310 South Industrial in Dallas, says he sold two bottles of beer to Lee Oswald on the morning of the assassination around 8:30 a.m. And this is according to a December 2nd, 1963 FBI report. Moore said that he asked for identification for the man to buy the alcohol. He provided an ID, and that ID said Lee Oswald, or H. Lee Oswald. He recalled that his birth date was 1939. He's sure of the name because he told his boss that Lee Oswald was a good Jewish name. so, yeah, Moore said that this man then came back about 30 minutes later and he bought candy, and he remembered this strange combination of beer and candy later, in addition to the name Lee Oswald. So the FBI then followed up with Moore's boss, George Worthington, there you go, to confirm what Moore said. And Worthington confirmed that, you know, Moore had mentioned this man coming in and buying beer and candy and mentioned the thing about Oswald being a good name. So, although Worthington said it was closer to 9:30 a.m. Okay. Whatever. That's pretty much corroborating it. And again, you have one more, instance of someone showing an ID using the name. I don't know why. I don't know why they would do that, because it doesn't incriminate him. It's just weird. But maybe fake Oswald just truly wanted to buy a beer and all he had was his Oswald on him. Maybe it's just like not great operational security, you know?
I quote Oswald, unquote, also applied for a job at the Southland Hotel garage. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, and on not great operational security, but also I guess if he's going to be drinking at 8:30 in the morning, it can show, hey, this guy's a drunk. He's unhinged. It's kind of like more of the unhinged, I suppose. Although I would imagine that would undermine the ability to make those shots argument. But yeah, applying for a job at the Southland Hotel. Hubert Morrow, who's a manager of the Southland Hotel garage, says Oswald came in and asked him for a job in the morning. And this is exactly 1 week before the assassination, so Friday, November 15th. Morrow recalled that the man asked him how high the parking lot building was and whether it would provide a good view of downtown Dallas. And he remembered that the name he wrote down was Lee Harvey Osborne. And the man then corrected him and said, no, my name is Oswald. The man waited 45 minutes to be interviewed by Morrow's boss. Then he left at 7:50 in the morning, and two other employees, Emmett Montgomery and Charlie Dabbs, confirmed the story. So, again, he's using the name Oswald. And what's, I guess, spicy about that is that it's a parking garage that's up high and it would be a good vantage point to shoot from. So.
The Texas Theater, at which or in which Lee Harvey Oswald was taken into custody, is also a focal point, and a quote Oswald, unquote, exited the rear of that theater by some accounts. Develop that for us, if you would, Matt.
Yeah, well, this is the, this is related to the, Carl Mather story, to the, you know, the T.F. White parking lot story, but basically, there are two Oswalds that are taken out of the Texas Theater, if you believe what Bernard Hare said, who's the guy who owned the store, the shop next door, and Butch Burroughs, who's the theater concessionaire. So, yeah, it's, you know, you can't be going out the front and then also come out the back at the same time. So, yeah, that's pretty much it.
It's not just that, Matt. There were more than one police reports that Oswald was apprehended in the balcony
yeah.
of the Texas Theater. All right. So you have the combination of the written reports, Bernard Hare and Burroughs all saying that a guy went out the back. You know, now, what makes Bernard Hare so interesting is that he didn't even realize this until he saw the movie JFK in 1992. All right. And then he started talking about this. He goes, I thought Oswald came out the back of the theater. I saw a guy come out the back of the theater that looked like Oswald. All right. So this is very, very, as Matt said, this is so interesting because if you link this guy who came out the back, okay, with the T.F. White story, all right, with the Vincent story, you know, it becomes very, very, not just interesting, but actually fascinating, you know, because everybody missed that for, what, 3 decades? Because nobody talked to Bernard Hare, you know? So it's a really, you know, it kind of like, you know, Matt's chapter is very good on its own. Okay. But if this stuff is true, it's really kind of the capstone, to his work there.
Another, sighting. And again, we're nearing the end of the program. We do want to talk about Mexico City and Soviet audio, but we have spoken about both of those in the past in front of this.
Dave, we don't have to talk about them. Let's get something else.
Okay. We've covered that at length. Fort Worth gun store sighting.
Yeah, Fort Worth gun store. All right.
isn't that Whitworth?
But this is Morgan's gun shop at Fort Worth, Texas. You know, I can actually read this whole thing very quickly. November 1st, a man bought ammunition for his rifle at Morgan's gun shop in Fort Worth, Texas, in a way that was memorable for those present. Witness Dewey Bradford told the FBI that the man was, quote, rude and impertinent, unquote. That would perhaps dovetail back to the unhinged Oswald impersonators. The man told Bradford that he had been in the Marine Corps. Bradford did not recall the caliber of ammo that the man bought later when Bradford and his wife and brother-in-law, who were also with him, saw the photos of Oswald in Life magazine. All three of them agreed that the person they saw at Morgan's gun shop was Lee Harvey Oswald. Despite this FBI report, the Warren Report ignored the Morgan gun shop incident. The Warren Report goes out of its way to address other instances of alleged Oswald sightings, but it never mentioned what Dewey Bradford saw at Morgan's gun shop. What significance do you see in that, gentlemen?
Well, I mean, it's pretty obvious if you put that together with the whole thing about the sighting at the other gun shop where the guy behind the counter said that some guy left a rifle here, all right, and it had the name, and he remembered the name Oswald, okay? I think it was an Argentine Mauser, if I remember. Am I right about that, Matt?
I don't know, actually.
Oh, okay.
I haven't looked at that one in a while.
But if you put those two together, I mean, really, I mean, now it's really unbelievable that these guys were lawyers on the Warren Commission. You know, almost all of them were attorneys. All right. And they missed something like this that was so obviously incriminating of a setup, of a frame up. Okay. Vincent Bugliosi in his 1600 page, you know, garbage compactor of a book. Okay. Reclaiming history. He actually says, I couldn't find any evidence of a frame up. You can't be serious. Okay. I mean, the gun shop with the rifle, the gun shop with the ammunition, the target practice at the Sportsdrome, and you can't find anything that indicates a frame up. Okay. I mean, please, Matt, did you write about the furniture store?
I don't know. Yes. Yeah, we did.
Go ahead, read that one. That's a really interesting one.
The furniture store, that I don't recall.
Oh, okay.
There was an interesting, one of the many, Oswald impersonators person for incidents I did not know about was the Leonard Hutchinson's grocery store and the checks that Oswald tried to cash there.
Yeah. That one, basically the guy that owned the grocery store said that, Oswald would always come in between Monday and Friday and not on the weekends when Oswald would normally visit with Marina and Ruth. But let's see, Hutchinson claimed to see Lee and Marina in the store between 6:45 and 7:30 on a Wednesday night, which is not normally when he would be there, speaking a foreign language that he believed to be Russian and accompanied by an elderly woman. He recognized Lee and Marina from the coverage on TV. So basically he's seeing Oswald there on a night when he's never there. And you know, that's the story there. That one's just one more instance. It's not as super tied to the case, although it does show him with, you know, an elderly woman. I don't know who that could be. He attempted to cash a check for $189 on Friday, November 8th. The amount of the check was higher than the store's limit of $25. So Hutchinson told the man that he was unable to cash the check. It's possible that Oswald could have been at Hutchinson's store to cash the check because it was on a Friday afternoon. We have no evidence of anyone writing Oswald a personal check for $189, which is, you know, almost $1,900 today. So anyway, it's one more thing that's not accounted for, but it doesn't make him look guilty. Hey, can I take 2 minutes or less just to cover these 3 points really quick?
Sure, go ahead.
All right. Absolutely not. We are down to the last 5 minutes or so of the program. I just wanted to, very briefly mention, I wanted to get to some of these other Oswald impersonators because there are so many of them, and many of them I did not know about, but I think it adds to the overall gravitas of this particular consideration. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay. Yeah. So super fast. When Oswald is growing up, he's like 17, 18, he works at this place called Pfister Dental Lab. And he's there at the same time with this guy, Palmer McBride, who testifies before the Warren Commission about how Oswald's like super communist, etc. But the problem is Palmer McBride's timeline of when he knew Oswald and worked with him for a period of like 6 months or so, it overlaps with when we know Oswald is in Japan. It's not possible. And, McBride has all of these things that are dated. He talks about going to this opera with Oswald that was only in the fall of, it was only during the time when the fall of 1957, the time when Oswald is in Russia. So that's one of them. That's a big one. Palmer McBride, it talks about Oswald being in New Orleans when the record says he is in Japan. A couple more in the Marines. Oswald's, direct report, Powers, Daniel Powers, he testifies to the Warren Commission and he brings his travel orders and he reads into the record, the travel, cause he's Oswald's, you know, commanding officer. He reads the travel orders into the record. All the numbers he reads, the student squadron, course number, class number, military occupational specialty, all those numbers conflict with, Folsom Exhibit 1, which shows Oswald's, travel orders. So there's two different people at the same time in different units with the same name. This is according to the Warren Report testimony. Crazy. Also, last thing, Japan. Okay. There's the famous story of Oswald being on guard duty, shooting into the woods in Taiwan. And then, you know, it's also true that Oswald was treated for gonorrhea in Atsugi. The gonorrhea treatment occurred at the same time as the records show that he's in Taiwan. There are records that support him being in both places at the same time. So, the HSCA wanted to know what's going on with this. So they asked the Department of Defense, you know, these records are inconsistent. He's being treated in Atsugi, but it says he's also in Taiwan. What's happening? And they said Oswald never left for Taiwan, from the Department of Defense to the HSCA. So all these stories about Oswald in the woods, you know, shooting into the woods and freaking out that are documented by all these people, they're all just making it up. Or are there two different people using the name Oswald at the same time? There you go.
Well, okay. Well, we have, I think, demonstrated this chokehold rather effectively and conclusively. We are right down the last couple of minutes. The book, well, where can people get it, et cetera? And also I want to put in a plug for Black Op Radio, which features, many of it, Paul and Jim and, Matt, have you been on Black Op?
I have not, but I've listened to many, many, many episodes.
Alrighty. The book, we're down the last couple of minutes here.
Yeah,
it's called The JFK Assassination Chokeholds, and it's by myself, Paul, Matt, Andrew Eiler, and Mark Adamczyk. The subtitle is That Inescapably Prove There Was a Conspiracy. Now, how good is this book? We just spent 2 hours talking about one chapter. Okay? So that I think that indicates something about the quality of the work that's inside it. And the concept is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that taken all together, Oswald was an innocent man. And as Matt said earlier, you can get it at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it almost any book, Abbe Books, et cetera. All right. There is a Kindle version. There's going to be a French version, and there's going to be an Audible version also soon. All right. And my website is kennedysandking.com. And Matt has a podcast. Isn't it called Solving JFK?
That's it. Solving JFK.
Right. And there's a lot of installments of it are on YouTube, and it does very well on YouTube.
Thank you. Yeah.
There are some of the venues that people can check out. This concludes For the Record program number 1326. Interview with Matt Crump and Paul Blow and James DeGenio about the Oswald impersonators and the JFK assassination chokeholds. For Matt, Paul, and Jim, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.